This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith episode number 99. It is early March 2015. Today, Chris Graham joins me to discuss the classic Bohemian Pilsner. Thank you to this week's sponsor, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're now offering a full 6 issues a year at a great discount. They're offering a new discount code, which gives you 15% off everything in their store. The new code is Beersmith2015. I encourage you to check out this great new magazine for homebrewers at beerandbrewing.com and use the offer code Beersmith2015 to get your 15% discount today. And also Brewha. Brewha Equipment Company designs novel brewing solutions that make brewing easier, faster, and more enjoyable, like the 3-in-1 conical fermenter that sanitizes itself without chemicals. The mash colander provides brew-in-a-bag simplicity with full mash tun control, and the temperature control valve that regulates fermentation temperature with just municipal water. Check out the latest brewing innovations at BrewhaEquipment.com. Again, that's BrewhaEquipment.com. And finally, a quick plug for the Beersmith mobile app for your iPhone, iPad, Android, or Kindle device. Create great beer recipes on the go and share them with your friends using Beersmith Mobile, available from iTunes, Google Play, or the Kindle App Store. And now let's jump into this week's episode. I'd like to welcome Mr. Chris Graham back to the show. Chris is the president of More Beer and More Flavor, Inc., and has appeared on the show a number of times before, including podcasts 16, 63, and 79 on Keg and Crit. It is great to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks, Brad. It's great to be here.
So how are you doing? How are things going out there at More Beer?
You know, More Beer is doing great. We're expanding product lines like crazy, and physically we're expanding as well. We're putting a new showroom in San Leandro, California, as well as expanding our warehousing. Our goals are just have a lot of product, a lot of selection, and ship fast.
And I see you're the president now. Is that true?
It is true. Not quite sure what the change is, but we just split my role up a little bit so I could specialize.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
So how's things going with you? How are the kids?
Doing well. Well, the twins are now 2 years old, and I thought I knew what terrible twos were, but I'm quickly learning that it's a whole new level. But it's fun, challenging, and they're just developing so fast that don't always get as much sleep as I'd like, but having fun along the way.
That's cool. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about Bohemian Pilsners today. So let's start out by describing this particular style of beer. I think most people are familiar with the Pilsner.
Yeah, well, you know, you take your Pilsner, and that's one broad style of beer. But you get down to the Bohemian Pilsner, and that's like my mecca, if you will, for just the most amazing tasting beer I've ever had in my life. For me, you know, the Bohemian Pilsner is the original Pilsner. You know, you get that extremely clear beer, usually like a nice gold color, not too straw colored, but more of a gold, complex malt, nice spicy Saaz aroma. Sometimes you get a little diacetyl with it, and that's okay. Sometimes you don't, depending on your fermentation and your yeast health. I don't actually mind it in that, but definitely don't want to have any esters. And you just want it super clean. And just for me, it is the perfect malt bitterness balance in the aftertaste.
So what are some examples of a true classic Pilsner as opposed to an American Pilsner?
You know, in the Bohemian Pilsner world, Pilsner Urquell is the, there you go, perfect. It is the godfather of Bohemian Pilsners. The hard thing is they don't necessarily travel well. So most of us here in the States, we have them and we're like, oh, okay, that, yeah, I see, that's a nice beer. But once in a while, I'll find somewhere that turns kegs quick, and they'll get a fresh keg of Pilsner Urquell, and it's like, oh my God. And then I've had chances to travel abroad and Europe and then even Czechoslovakia, and then you have it there and it's like, holy cow, it is almost a different beer. You know, Budweiser, of course, I'm talking about Budvar, not Anheuser-Busch.
Budvar, of course, is brewed in the Czech Republic, right?
Exactly. And it's a beautiful example if you can get your hands on that. And Czechvar is what you'll usually see that called here in the United States. But actually, there's some more and more craft breweries are starting to do a really good job of putting them out as well.
So there's Pilsner Urquell. Now, this comes from Pilsen, Czechoslovakia. Is that right?
Correct. First brewed in what? It was right there, 1842.
So 1842, I guess they started brewing the Pilsner beer in Bohemia?
Exactly. Well, it was actually in Pilsen they started brewing it, and they had borrowed their brewing techniques from Bavaria, where pale lagers were kind of becoming the standard. However, they incorporated their Moravian two-row Saaz hops and their super soft water to really produce this whole different type of lager known as the Bohemian Pilsner.
So it was really a combination of things that came together historically to produce this particular style, right?
Exactly. And that for me is why this is like the ultimate for a homebrewer to shoot for as they build all their skills, because you need a compounding knowledge to really be able to replicate this.
Now, is it a tough beer to brew? Is it very difficult to brew something like this?
It is, in my opinion. This isn't your starter project. This isn't your first few beers that you brew. This is one that you need a clear understanding of fermentation styles. You got to have your yeast proper. You've got to have your fermentation temp control. And it really comes down to there's nothing to hide behind. This beer is malt forward, crystal clear beer. So you don't have any esters, you don't have any cloudiness. So you got to have all your brewing techniques in line to be able to produce this repeatedly.
I know a lot of people that are just starting out brewing, they'll go out and buy a lager kit or a Pilsner kit and try and brew something like what they buy in the store. And it's pretty hard to do that, isn't it?
Exactly. That was my very first beer personally that I went to homebrew. I was trying to make a Sam Adams Boston Lager clone. This is now 20 something years ago. And I remember just being super excited. And then the more I read, the more I realized this isn't the best beer to brew the first time, because I didn't have the money to have temp controlled fermentation. I didn't have experience doing lagers. And guess what? I wanted to drink that beer quick. I didn't want to wait the time that it takes to do the full process correctly.
I'm assuming it came out perfect, right?
Oh yeah, no. my roommates in college loved it, because guess what? It was free.
Yeah, that's the best kind of beer, is free beer.
I was gonna say, thank God I had them, because I probably would have quit brewing right away if I didn't have someone to drink all my terrible beer as I learned proper techniques and progress. We didn't have great podcasts like this 20 something years ago to bring our learning techniques up fast.
Yeah, information was short. I remember when I started brewing, there was only one or two books out, and they weren't particularly great, actually.
Oh yeah, no, most of cleaning was done with bleach and everything was permitted. I remember the first pamphlet I had on brewing talked about getting a trash can, like an office trash can to do your fermentation in.
Yeah. Or the bathtub, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that would be terrible.
Okay. Well, let's talk about brewing a Pilsner. Let's start with a grain bill. What grains are most appropriate to use?
Really, it all comes down to the malted barley, the Moravian Pilsner, and if you could find floor malted, that is just like the end all be all. So personally, I like Weyermann's for doing this style of beer. It just is a beautiful grain, both just eating it raw. What is their technical? The Weyermann floor malted Bohemian Pilsner malt. It's a little less modified than most malts are. Not much. You could still single infuse mash.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point. I know a lot of the malts that were used were actually traditionally were under modified a little bit.
And exactly. And we'll cover that in a little bit in terms of mashing technique. You had to go through these different techniques back then because they didn't have the technology in the malt house to really get it to be a highly processed product back then. You know, you're thinking of people drying things using a hand rake, raking it out. Whereas now we have automated equipment that can measure things from moisture levels, temperature throughout. And so they control the process so much better now.
Right. Right. What's different about Moravian malt? Is that just refer to a particular area where this is grown?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a crop region, and it's more of a malting style than anything else, of just really promoting the malt forward aspects of those characters. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have your two rows and your six rows and your Pilsen's style selected grains, but then you have your regions and where they're grown, and that's going to make the biggest impact.
Because all barleys are not created the same, right?
Correct. Yeah. And now we're going to contend with GMOs some point in the near future, I'm sure, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they will be created the same, Brad. Yeah.
So the malt is obviously a Pilsner malt, and Pilsner is a little bit lighter than the traditional pale malt that we use, right?
Yeah, typically your SRM is in like the less than a point to 2 points of color spectrum. So they're usually going to lend itself to a very pale or straw colored beer. A lot of times in a good Bohemian Pilsner, your color again will come from the way you do the mash typically to get more of that golden color. However, you can add other grains, and a lot of people do, especially for mouthfeel. This is a style of beer where you want a bit more mouthfeel than, say, your Munich Helles or your lighter, paler Pilsners. So Carapils, Vienna, some of those type malts are commonly found. And depending on your mash schedule, I've had people using Melanoidin malts, just small percentages, mm-hmm. to really bring out some of the malt characters when doing a single infusion mash.
But a traditional Pilsner or Kale is really just 100%.
Yes.
Pale malt, right?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Pilsner malt.
Yes, well, yes.
And I guess that's another point, is it's very difficult to get the really, really light color if you're brewing with extract, right?
Exactly. So your style of which way the malt happened is going to dictate what color you're going to get. So in referring to that, a malt extract is always going to be darker than doing all grain.
That's due to the process they use to make the extract. It actually darkens it, right?
Exactly. And you get a Maillard reaction when doing the dehydration, removing the water content, and it's going to naturally darken. And then as malt extract ages, it naturally darkens over time. And your wort would too. If you tried to just save sterile wort, it's going to darken. Or your final beer will darken over time too, in the same Maillard reaction. So malt extract's not going to lend you as much of a lightness that you can get all grain. However, I've had some good examples of Bohemian Pilsner done with extract. But when doing extract, you're probably going to want to add Carapils and Melanoidin malt to give you a little bit more of those complex mouthfeels and malt character.
Right, and you're not going to get the same color. You're going to end up with a little bit darker beer, which is fine as long as you have the same taste, flavor profile.
Exactly. You know, that's the beauty of homebrew. Are we trying to sell this extract beer to the open market? No, we're brewing for fun. We're brewing to share with our friends, and we're brewing for flavor. And I believe you can really get great flavors out of extract when doing properly.
Now, you talked about the use of Melanoidin malt, and that one of the things that does is it helps bring out that malty character without going through a traditional decoction or this multi-step mash, right?
Exactly. And it's, you know, I'm not exactly sure how they do the character of Melanoidin, but they're smarter than I am. But when doing those styles of mashing, that is naturally brought out. So what we should really talk about is the mash style of the time that these first came out. And I think if you're a home brewer, ultimately wanting to replicate this style of beer, that's why I said in the beginning, this is not a beer you brew in the beginning. This is one that you really want to have all your techniques down before you brew, mm-hmm. if you're going for the ultimate flavors. And the style of mash that you should really be wanting to do is the decoction style mash.
So let's switch over and talk about mash profiles for a minute, since we're on the grain topic. What do you recommend for a Pilsner or Kell type style?
Well, I would say ultimately your goal should be shooting for a triple decoction when doing this style of beer. And I say ultimately, it doesn't have to be the first 10 times you brew this beer, or even 20 times if you particularly love this style of beer.
Right, because decoction's pretty complicated, right?
It's very time intensive.
Can you summarize what a decoction is for people that aren't familiar with it?
Absolutely. So a decoction starts with going in and doing your traditional, having a traditional mash tun, and then pulling 1/3 of the grain and water in that mash tun out, bringing it to another vessel. And we should probably talk about steps that are done traditionally. You have your acid rests, which is where you would traditionally dough in to get your 109s-ish Fahrenheit temperature. You let it rest for a certain amount of time there. 15 minutes is usually ample. Pull out your 1/3. Then you're going to bring that 1/3 up to your protein rest, 120s. Let that sit for another 15 minutes. Then bring it up to beta amylase in the 140s. Then alpha amylase in the 150s. Then to about 170 to 175 to denature the enzymes, then bringing it all the way up to a boil. And this is the part, I think, when people first learn about a decoction mash, that they're saying, what the hell would you bring your mash up to a boil? How is that going to work? And it's that is really what's going to bring this malt, melanoidin, Maillard reaction, because you've made all of that into sugars, and then you're going to boil those sugars for a few minutes before taking that whole slurry. And yes, it was grains and liquid and everything. It goes against everything you learn about single infusion mashing in terms of temperatures and extraction of tannins and such. You're going to bring that entire bit back to your mash tun, and that 1/3 amount is actually going to bring your entire mash up to your next raise.
Right.
So in doing a triple decoction, usually you're going to start at 109, and that's not a decoction. Then you do your decoction, that brings you up into like about 120. And it's amazing how well it does it without you doing any other temp corrections.
Right. And it was used actually before we had thermometers, right?
Exactly.
And that was back in 1842.
Yep. So if you can imagine, they had probably very complicated systems to move this boiling porridge, because that's essentially what it feels like, right, at the time.
Any stage, you're pulling out a portion of the mash and boiling it and then throwing it back in, and then that raises the temperature of the whole mixture.
Exactly. So you go through one decoction and that gets you into the protein, another decoction that gets into beta amylase, another decoction that gets you into alpha amylase. So it's a pretty amazing, intricate way to get you there. And I say it's the ultimate. It's the ultimate mainly for historical reasons,
right,
for myself to do this. But it's typically to do that, it's like a 14-hour brew day.
It's a long day. Yeah, I've done it a couple times just to say I could. But
and that's exactly it. So when I was in college, my parents had moved to Switzerland for my dad's job. And so I had nowhere to go home for Thanksgiving break, where all my friends would go home, see their families or whatnot. I just so bored.
Said, why don't I just do a decoction instead?
Exactly. I'm like, I've got time. I've got no distractions. So this is where you really got to be careful on those brew days. You don't want to drink, because this is a long game. This isn't a short one. So it turned into something fun when we started More Beer. Mm-hmm. One of my business partners at that time, since retired, his family was all over the place, so he was around on Thanksgiving. So we started doing it here at the shop, 14-hour brew days. We would kind of tag team, so kind of break the jobs up and make it easier. He would help a lot with the setup, getting ready for the day, so that I would come in for the mash and the other things had been set up for me. Then he would handle kind of the boil parts, and then I could rest and eat and such, and come back and do the cooling and the pitching of the yeast and oxygenation and all of that. And in the meanwhile, we would deep fry a turkey and friends would come and visit, and it turned into a tradition for about 5 or 6 years. That's nice. It was pretty fun. So for me, it's got this whole stigma of a social event, a beautiful beer being brewed. We made our errors and mistakes, and we'll kind of cover those towards the end here. But it's just a ton of fun. And the learning I had to do every year to make that next year beer just a little bit better, whether it was learning about water chemistry, learning about oxygenation of your yeast pitch sizes, yeast temperatures, and what they do. Every year we just tried to do it better. Then I got married and I haven't done one since.
Yeah. For those of us that have real lives, what's the alternative to doing this 14-hour decoction?
You know, the next best step in my book is a single infusion mash for about 45 minutes in your Al Family's range, or 152s, 154, somewhere right in that ballpark. And then a single decoction if you can, because that's not going to take you much time to do that. You just have to have the equipment. And the best equipment are these newer style stainless kettles with as big of a aluminum plate on the bottom as you can find. Our heavy duty series are awesome for this. I do it as part of our Siebel class, where we do a decoction, and there is just no cleanup afterwards. Nothing burns on the bottom. Nice. Because of this huge aluminum. And not all kettles are made equally. I've had other aluminum clad bottoms that are much thinner aluminum, and thusly we end up with more scorching, and that'll come through in the flavor, and it's harder to clean up afterwards.
What about a big stainless steel kettle?
Well, these are stainless steel, but if you put direct flame under the stainless and you're not stirring constantly, I mean constantly, you're going to end up with a little bit of scorching as you're trying to get that up
on the bottom there.
Yeah. Exactly. And some of that, a little bit, not bad. A lot or mid-range is horrible.
And then finally, if you really want to cheat, you just throw a little melanoidin malt in instead, right?
I was going to say, and then, you know, so that's kind of this cool way to get the melanoidin characters, but add a lot of work. And then just if you want to just try it, see if you like the beer style, do an extract, steep melanoidin malts, add some maltodextrin.
Or see you can what do a single think. Infusion with a little bit of it too, right?
Exactly. And then all grain, you can steep or put that in with the mash even better. Then you can use carapils instead of maltodextrin.
So how much melanoidin does it take with a, you know, let's say you go 100% Pilsner malt or almost 100% Pilsner malt. How much melanoidin would you add?
At less than 10%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just a little bit. A little bit goes a long way. Taste the malt first. See what you think. If you're going to add, let's say, 10 pounds of malt extract or of your Moravian grains, then maybe up to a pound of melanoidin.
Okay. Well, let's talk about hops now. Certainly a dominant flavor in this particular style. What hops do you recommend?
You only got to know one. Czech Saaz.
Saaz.
And it's a beautiful hop. It is just spicy and floral, but yet is nothing like what we're used to as an American hop. It is not pungent like pine needles and that kind of world. It is a much more noble character type hop.
And it is a noble hop too, right?
Correct. And so really, Saaz. Really, you're only adding in your bittering hop and a flavor hop. You're not going for grassy characters that you would get out of a whirlpool or a dry hop.
So that's what I was going to ask you next is what about the hop schedule? What hop schedule do you recommend?
Personally, I am depends how long you do your boil. On this boil, if I'm doing a single infusion and I want a little bit more color to it, I will probably boil longer. I'll probably do a full 90-minute boil.
Well, and there's some advantages from a clarity perspective to boiling longer too, I think, right?
Exactly. And so for those reasons, I will do that longer boil. For my triple decoction day, I'm trying to shave any time I can. So I'm probably doing more like a 75-minute or 60-minute boil.
But you're telling if you're doing a longer like this, something probably a 90-minute boil is standard, right?
Exactly. And that'll help drive your clarity you know, your protein break much better, help you do your separation better, get you better clarity, plus give you a little bit of color from the tiny bit of caramelization you're going to get. So I would definitely add the saaz for that. And then personally, I add about a 15 minute till flame out for my flavor addition.
So two hop additions is what you're looking at in the schedule. And how do you break them out?
I probably go a little bit more weighted flavor over boil, but just going for like about a 40 IBU range is really my target, and trying to get a large majority of that is obviously going to come from the boil, but definitely want to get the flavor in there as well.
So you don't use whirlpool hops. I assume you don't dry hop, right?
Correct. Neither of those. No flame out, no dry hop, because I'm not going for the characters of the hop. I'm going spiciness that you get from a longer exposure time.
So let's talk about yeast. Obviously, you want a fairly clean fermenting lager yeast here.
For me, it's all about, White Labs is the 802 Czech Budweis. And so that's
probably an authentic beer or authentic yeast from that area, right?
Exactly. Chris won't divulge who he was given that strain from, but I suspect it's one of the bigger breweries there, and it's just a beautiful yeast that hits all the flavor profiles just right. I mean, you finish fermenting, I can almost read a newspaper through my carboy. It clears out that well, highly attenuating. 75 to 80% attenuation, which is kind of funny because that's, you know, almost like your California 001 1056 style attenuation. So
it attenuates a lot.
Yet you get this beautiful malt left over from it. So while it eats the sugars, but the way you've handled your mashing schedule and such, and the yeast itself, it leaves behind the malt character, which is key to this beer style.
Now, water also plays a really important role in this beer style. What do you recommend for water?
So this is one of those things. It's if you really want to get into water and read the latest brewer's publication book on water, listen to Brad's podcast on water, buy your Lamont water kits, work with John Palmer's stuff on water.
John has a lot to say about it.
Exactly. You want low sulfate, low carbonate water. Soft is key. Generally, you want under 50 ppm of hardness. Now, don't let that scare you away from brewing this. Personally, an easy way to achieve a softer water is to blend in some either RO or distilled water with your regular tap water in order to achieve that. 50-50 is usually good unless you got extremely hard water, which case 75-25 will probably do well for you.
So you're blending the water to get a nice soft water profile, right?
Exactly.
Now, obviously, fermentation temperature comes into play here, and also the fermentation schedule is really important for a style like this. It takes a little bit longer than your traditional ale, right?
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about doing everything, and I apologize to your listeners. I'll kind of talk in usually two different levels of what you would want to do. Perfect world in this beer style is for me to cool it under my pitch temp. So I want to cool this thing into the 40s.
So you need some really cold water going into your chiller then, right?
Exactly. And I use for this style of beer, when I really want to cool it, I use my friend Jamil came up with the Whirlpool immersion chiller technique. And then I've got ways of getting that colder by cooling the water that goes through them as the temp of the whole bath gets lower.
Yeah, I use like a two-stage chiller. So I actually have a secondary coil that I immerse in nice water, if you will.
That's exactly what we're doing here. And I'm trying to get that down into the 40s, literally. Then I transfer into my fermenters, let it warm slightly over time and settle out while it's doing that. Then I have conicals so I can dump a little bit, because I really want to get as much sediment out of it before I'm pitching in this particular style of beer, because I don't want any of that trub to have big impact. So bringing it up to 50 degrees for my pitch, pitching copious quantities of yeast, and fermenting between 48 and 51 usually. And that can take 2 to 3 weeks typically,
just for that first stage, right?
For that first stage. And people freak out usually their first lagers and their first, especially when they have temp control. They freak out because the lag to where you see visual activity is a lot longer at those temperatures than when they're warm. Yeast loves warm environments. And you're kind of stressing it out by putting it in this cooler environment.
And also you get all these wonderful off flavors and smells from the lager yeast, right?
Exactly. It's a totally different aroma. Don't freak out. Because
a lot of sulfur, rotten egg.
Yep. And once we get to about 95% done of fermentation, 99 to 98% done, we'll typically do a diacetyl rest. And that's what drives a lot of those characters out that you produce, those rotten eggs and diacetyl characters and such, by bringing it up to the 60s for about 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. And that's the diacetyl rest. And it's done how long into the fermentation, roughly?
2 to 3 weeks, to say.
2 to 3 weeks, right?
Yeah. So I'm talking about kind of a perfect lager fermentation. Now let's talk about someone's first time or first times brewing and they want to make a lager and want to have good success. A way that I coach people through it is get the yeast going quickly. If you have to have temp control refrigeration to do this, but get the yeast going by maybe pitching in the low 60s.
Right.
And then you have to be home to be able to start ramping your temperature down every 6 hours or so. So a lot of times I say, especially if you're in glass, when you start seeing any visual signs, by the time you see those signs, you want to be in the low 50s, but you start in the 60s to kind of incubate a little bit.
So maybe that gives the yeast a chance to jumpstart a little bit before you
jumpstart a little bit. Yeah. But within my goals, within 12 hours of pitching that yeast, hopefully you've gotten yourself down slowly, incrementally into the low 50s, so that the primary fermentation, that first, what you would hate to happen is yeast kicks in the low 60s and ferments. You'd be surprised how fast. I know you, Brad, won't be, but other people would be surprised how fast yeast can really rip through your sugars. So you don't want that to happen. If that happens, you're going to have some off flavors. You're going to have some esters. You're going to have some things that aren't as desirable as if you could have done that fermentation in the low 50s. But based off of these temperatures, you're going to find you got to be a slightly advanced brewer in that you have to control the fermentation.
So brewing a lager takes a little bit of patience, doesn't it?
It sure does. And that's why it doesn't make for a good first batch, because as we just discussed, you got 2 to 3 weeks of primary fermentation, then you'll go through a 24-hour diacetyl rest, then you'll generally decide if you're going to keg or if you're going to bottle. If you're going to bottle, you're going to package, but then you're going to lager the beer for another 4 to 6 weeks before you start drinking it. So
take as much as twice as long as an ale, right?
At least, you know, you're talking 2 to 3 months minimum before you're drinking that beer. And it will peak after a few months too. So, you know, just because it's ready to drink doesn't mean it's at its perfect peak yet.
Right, right. So if I recall, it takes almost twice as much yeast versus a lager versus an ale, right?
Exactly. In a recent brew I did on a Bohemian Pilsner, ended up a little bit higher gravity and did a calculation, and I ended up using 4 vials of yeast for the pitch. So quite a bit more than I would typically do on an ale.
Right, right. Well, do you have any advice on finishing and bottling or kegging this particular style?
Yeah. So if we got to handle things differently in the process, if we're going to bottle versus if we're going to keg. And I think a lot of people don't notice this or don't look at it from a bottling perspective, because most people who get to doing a Pilsner have the ability to keg because they have temp control. But for those who don't or want to bottle, once you've done that 2 to 3 weeks in primary, than your diacetyl rest, that's kind of the ideal time to now bottle, because after that, we're going to lager at, you know, 35 to 40 degree temperatures. And if you tried it for 4 to 6 weeks, so if you tried to do that in your fermenter, all your yeast would pretty much settle out. And you would either have to add more yeast at bottling, which is tricky in its own right, or you end up with vastly undercarbonated beers, which this beer style should have a nice carbonation level. It shouldn't be a flat beer. So I suggest if you're bottling, you bottle right then. Then you got to wait a few weeks or, you know, 10 days to carbonate at slightly warmer temperatures. You don't have to go all the way to high 70s or anything, but it's going to take a little bit longer the colder you are. But then once it's carbonated properly, then you're going to go into the fridge for 4 to 6 weeks of true cold aging or lagering. But lagering's better done in bulk, in mass. You get your reactions that you're actually getting, your chemical breakdowns and such, much faster the more liquid's there. So I think you're better off kegging, and in which case you can go to your fermenter, whatever that is. After you're done with your diacetyl rest, I will typically rack, go into a carboy with as little oxygen headspace as possible, go back into the fridge, go 4 to 6 weeks of cold aging. And in that time frame, I can usually see a slight color change, a little bit darkening. And a lot of that darkening is the actual fact that I can see all the way through the carboy at that point, where before I was seeing yeast and such haze on the liquid depth. And usually by the end of that 4 to 6 weeks, it is so crystal clear that you can see all the way through that carboy to the other side. And it's kind of a cool feeling that you made something so perfect. And then at that point, go into the kegging process, and everything is handled the same from there on out. And going back to the bottling versus kegging, if you did want to do bottling for competitions, for things like that, you're way better off kegging it, carbonating it to that perfect level, and then bottling it out off the keg, and then going to competitions, because then you won't have any sediment or anything like that to kind of alter the beer's character over time.
Mm-hmm. And this particular beer style is carbonated at a pretty high level, right?
Exactly. I wish I had looked up the carbonation chart beforehand, but it's definitely on the higher of the scale. You want that carbonic acid bite to help balance everything else.
So what kind of flaws might you commonly see in this type of beer?
Oh boy. A lot of them are style flaws or processing flaws. So we could start with the mash itself. If you're decoction mashing, a big flaw I get a lot on my own too, especially before I learned about these great cladded bottom kettles, was scorching. So getting a little bit of that, burnt character, smoky, and you can't pass this on off as a Rausch beer. You think you can, but you really can't. It's just wrong. One of the best ones we did.
Pilsner Rausch, of course, very famous style.
Exactly. And one time we built a automated mixing arm for the decoction, thinking like, hey, we'll automate this process of keeping the bottom stirred. Well, it failed to get 100% of the grain moving, and it scorched. It was one of the most perfectly fermented. Everything was right. You just had this hint of smoke to it. We ended up having a huge party. I just couldn't in my right mind serve that beer. So I threw in some raspberry extract. That beer was gone in 2 or 3 minutes, 20 gallons of it gone. Nice. So you mask the flavors. So that's the first thing I always look for in one that could go wrong. The next thing is fermentation. Temperature can cause all kinds of off characters, from fusel alcohols to esters to all kinds of starved yeast create their own profiles of off characters, wrong temperatures, green apple characters. I've had beers with the whole spectrum. Then those can also a lot of times lead to color or clarity issues as well. So I would say that's the nutshell. This is the most flawed ridden style because every mistake you made, you will know when you're done.
So, so a tough style to brew.
Exactly. And that's why I for me, it's the mecca. It's the, you know, I love IPAs. I love a good hoppy beer, but quite frankly, I'm not going to say they're easy, but they're easier to make a great one than they are a good lager.
So Chris, do you have any closing advice on brewing a perfect Pilsner?
Well, you said it earlier, be patient. The process of brewing, fermentation, aging is longer than your typical beer. But not only that, it's all about how much you understand and are comfortable with all the processes. Like everything, brewing's a hobby that you gain experience at. And as you gain more experience at fermentation sciences, as you gain more experience with yeast handling, with lagering, with all of those things, you're going to get better and better at it. So don't let the first time you try it keep you from trying it further if you don't get the result you want.
Excellent. Well, I thought I'd give you a minute to talk about some of the things going on at More Beer. What are you guys up to?
Well, we are in the process of opening our latest showroom. So if you're ever in San Leandro, California, which is near the Oakland airport,
please. Is this a new location near where you were, or did you move?
A new location near where we are. An opportunity came up. It was a homebrew store before, and we've known the owner, so we took it over, rebranding. We're about to basically gut it and put in all new fixtures and just make it another great showroom for people to come in, get hands-on with equipment and ingredients and check things out.
Fantastic. And that's in what location?
San Leandro, California, which is right by Oakland Airport.
Okay, good. And some of the other things going on?
We're growing our product lines like crazy, always bringing in new malts, new hops. So we have a whole new series of them coming through. We have a contest going on right now. You can enter every day if you wish, and that will be win a trip to the National Homebrewers Conference, get VIP into the Brewing Network Party. Happens to be our 20th anniversary this year, so we're hosting a big party.
Congratulations, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so homebrewing's growing up.
Well, that's great. Thank you again, Chris. Really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, Brad.
So again, thank you to Chris Graham for appearing on the show. Chris is the president of More Beer and More Flavor, Inc. He's also been active in the AHA as a former governing committee member and Brewers Association board member. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again to Chris Graham for appearing today. And thanks to our sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Each issue of this new magazine is packed with great tips on brewing, beer styles, technical articles, craft beer, and more. Pick up your subscription today from beerandbrewing.com and use the offer code BEERSMITH2015 for an additional 15% off everything on their site when you purchase today. Also, Bruja Equipment Company, whose innovative 3-in-1 brewing systems and conical fermenter lets you mash, brew, and ferment in a single vessel. Check out their innovative solutions at BrujaEquipment.com. Finally, my Beersmith mobile software app lets you design, modify, and brew great beer recipes from your phone or tablet. Pick it up today from iTunes, Google Play, or the Amazon App Store. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.